From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made with a series of questions. How did makeup, World War II, and communism create U.S. healthcare? Where does the hashtag symbol come from? Is poison Halloween candy a myth? Why are there so few women in computer science? And why does the heart symbol look that way? These are all questions addressed on the PBS digital studio show, The Origin of Everything, and the host, Danielle Bainbridge, leads the team behind answering these questions. She's a doctoral student at Yale who burst onto the YouTube scene and is making her mark. She's my guest this hour to talk about the origins of The Origin of Everything and also about American education, diversity in media, and more. Danielle Bainbridge, welcome to Connections.
Thank you so much for having me.
In your series, you're looking at the origin of everything, but when it comes to the origin of your show, and even earlier, the origin of your relationship with social media, there's sort of a twist. You were never a big social media user, and you thought YouTube sounded kind of silly. Is that true?
Yeah, this is all very true. I thought that YouTube was mostly a platform for people who were into things that I wasn't into. So a place that people went to see, you know, nature videos or science-related content. And I myself am a huge history nerd, and I love books, and I love arts and culture, more related content. So in its early inceptions, the first person who ever told me about YouTube, he said that he and his friends used it to look up videos of snakes that eat mice. And I thought, that sounds horrible. Why would anyone ever want to make a website dedicated to something like that? Even through time, I wasn't really too savvy about social media. All of my social media pages were made by friends of mine, and I only have two, not two friends, but two social media pages. and so I wasn't really too savvy before we started the show, but then a lot of that came out of building the content for a larger audience and thinking about, well, what are the trends? What are people into? What do people go online to look for? And thinking about my own habits and also thinking about, well, I want viewers like me, but I'm also interested in viewers who watch something for 6 hours a day. So I was interested in looking at both of those sides of things.
So how does a PhD candidate wind up as a YouTube star? And I say that in the most positive way, because when we think about YouTube stars and YouTube videos, maybe our minds go to cat videos or something like that, not necessarily academics. So how did you wind up becoming the host of this show?
It was also an unusual origin. So I am finishing my PhD here at Yale in American Studies and African American Studies, and I got an email one day from our administrator in the department that said someone's left a phone number on the department mailbox for you, and she says she's from PBS. And so I happened to be in the department that day, in the building. I came down from the offices and I said, could you play the message for me? And I listened to it and then burst out laughing because I thought, oh, this has to be some elaborate scam that they use to lure unsuspecting academics into some sort of nefarious thing. So I didn't think it was a real thing. And she and I were laughing a lot about it because I thought, this can't be for real. But after hearing the message a couple other times, I went online and searched the name of the production company and the name of the woman in casting who had called me, and it was a real person. So I called the number back after thinking it through, and it turned out that they were looking for someone to launch this history show. So the production company that I collaborate with to do Origin of Everything, who produced our show, Corn Haber Brown, they had other shows with PBS Digital Studios, Idea Channel, which is a pop culture sort of philosophy theme show. And then there was Infinite Series, which is a show about complex math, and Space Time, which is a show about astrophysics. So I saw that there were these other hosts who were also academics like me who were doing these series. And I went in and I spoke to my now producers, and we got along pretty well. And they were interviewing people just to see if they were interested in it. I also write creative nonfiction, and I sort of work online. I'm interested in speaking to broader audiences, both inside and outside of academia. So I think that we had a lot of traction from the beginning because we had that shared common interest in thinking about how to make this work for a general audience, for a broad audience that is interested and invested and has a lot of engagement, but maybe not a lot of background in the field. So I came back and I did some interviews and I did a really short screen test and I sent them some pieces of writing. And I found that it was really easy to work with them, which was the biggest persuasive factor in my wanting to see if I could get this job. And then when they decided that they wanted to go forward and we'd collaborate on the show, it was my birthday in April a year ago. It was a very unusual birthday present. So they called me while I was in lecture looking around at my students. And I thought, oh, well, this is a different sort of birthday gift, but it was still fortuitous. And we decided to move forward from there. So it really was a merging of interests because they're invested and interested in making entertainment content. They produce a lot of comedy and they also make a lot of web content for folks who are interested in complex questions. And I was interested in making videos and content for a broader audience who wanted to learn more about in-depth historical research. So it was a happy marriage, I guess, in a certain way. And we went forward from there collaborating on the show. But it is a kind of unusual side job.
When you look on the website and you see topics like why do kids have their own bedrooms or mm-hmm. where does the hashtag symbol come from? These are things that after I read them, I'm like, huh, I never really thought about that, but I want to know. And so you're mm-hmm. you're finding topics that everyone can relate to. It's such a strength of the show. How do you mm-hmm. choose some of those topics? Because some are clearly rooted in history, like how did Martin Luther King Jr. get a holiday? Or others mm-hmm. like how did makeup, World War II, and communism create U.S. healthcare? But others, mm-hmm. like the true origin of killer clowns, are a little more obtuse. So how do you make yeah. decisions about the types of topics that you're covering?
Well, one of the great things about the team that works on Origin of Everything, including my producers who I've already mentioned, but our graphic designer, Noel Smith, and everyone who does the editing, is that we're all similar in the same way that we're really interested in making the show great, and we're interested in finding topics that people can relate to and that they want to think about really deeply, even if they seem trivial or silly. And a lot of the ideas come from us talking it out and talking to each other. I take suggestions from everyone who works with me. I try to think it through because it's also that if you're trying to find an episode topic with broad appeal, you can't just rely on your own body of knowledge because then it would be a very narrow kind of show. I'm trying to remember one of the funnier ones. Oh, so I was drinking, what is it called? Monster energy drink in the office one day because I was tired and we had to film. And I'm standing in the studio and I was drinking them. And then everyone's talking about the different flavors of them that they enjoyed. You know, someone was saying, well, I really like these ones, or I only like the blue one, or I only like this. And I said, when did we start thinking of colors as flavors? And we were joking about that a little bit and kind of kicking it around, how grape flavoring doesn't taste like grapes. And someone said, that's a good idea. You should do one on that. And it became our episode on the history of artificial flavors, which is something that people are concerned about genuinely. They're concerned about the additives in their food and why are they there and are they harmful? Should we be eating so many of them? Is it normal that grape flavor doesn't taste like grape? So that became an episode topic. So sometimes it comes from very unexpected interactions, but usually it comes from kicking around a few ideas, or sometimes we try to connect them to other things. So the Killer Clowns episode, as odd as it seems, came out right before the reboot of It. So we thought, oh, that's a good idea. You know, you could connect that to a movie that's getting a lot of coverage and people are expressing all of these things online about clown phobia and all these. And so there was already a conversation kind of happening and we were able to launch ourselves into that.
It's funny you mentioned that because we did a show on this talk show, Connections, about why people are afraid of clowns. And after that show, we got some emails and some phone calls from clowns. And one of them came from, I think it was the nephew or the cousin of Bozo the Clown. And I thought, I haven't thought about Bozo the Clown in years, but.
Yeah, I had a very similar story that I was sharing this morning that when we did the Killer Clown episode, I expected to get a lot of messages from people who were afraid of clowns. I did not expect quite so many professional clowns to reach out to me. We started with one, and then by the end it was about 20, and they were sharing them on platforms about clown performance. But then when I really thought about it, it wasn't any more unusual than if I had done an episode, say, on jazz, and jazz musicians emailed me. It's no crazier than that. I think it's just when you see a message and someone's profile picture is a tiny thing of a clown, it's somewhat alarming because you don't see clowns often if you're not either performing as a clown or going to venues that have clown performance like circuses or birthdays or different theaters. So it was kind of refreshing to see so many of them so fiercely proud of their art, and they wanted to talk to me and they had book suggestions. And I think some of them assumed that I was afraid of clowns, and that's why I had done the episode, but I'm certainly not. No, not at all. I've never found clowns upsetting. I just think of it as another kind of performance. I mean, no more scary than seeing gymnastics. I find trapeze artists sometimes, I find that kind of terrifying because I'm always scared they're going to fall. But clowning, I don't think of as particularly creepy.
Listeners, my guest is Danielle Bainbridge. She is the host of The Origin of Everything from PBS Digital Studios. And one thing I'd like to talk about the episodes themselves are the bigger picture issues that you're addressing. So even if you're narrowly focusing on one particular topic, maybe why do kids have their own bedrooms, or the Rosa Parks story, you're capturing the broader spectrum, the broader experience. Mm-hmm. And one of the common themes that I've found after watching some of those episodes is how the media and the way that cultural situations shape our perceptions of history. And we find ourselves often rewriting history because of those perceptions. And I mentioned Rosa Parks before. I think that's a great example. So I'd like to listen to a clip from your episode called Is the Rosa Parks Story True? And before we hear that clip, tell us about why your team decided to explore that subject.
Well, there are a lot of different reasons behind that topic. One, because Rosa Parks has had such an interesting life and biography as a civil rights activist, as someone who was deeply invested in civil rights, in activism for women, for Black women. She was an active member of the NAACP. And it's such an unusual retelling to think of her as some passive woman who was so tired that she couldn't get up from her seat, whereas the real story for us was so captivating that she had all of these different histories as an investigator for the NAACP, that she was always agitating for civil rights. And we wanted to tell a broader story that also tied into our need to do a couple of episodes for Black History Month. So that was a lot of the motivation that came out of the Rosa Parks episode. And we were really delighted to be able to share it and to share some of the great work that's come out about her life and about her story, including the documentary The Rape of Recy Taylor, as well as other, you know, biographies and autobiographies that have come out about her. So it was a great episode and we were happy to do it.
Is it frustrating for you as an academic to know that kids in school these days are being taught that Rosa Parks was a tired woman on the bus, and they may not have the full story that she was an activist? We recently talked about the Recy Taylor documentary on this program, and for many of the listeners we heard from, it was the first time they heard that Rosa Parks was involved with the civil rights movement prior to the Montgomery bus boycott.
I think the frustration for me about the way history gets taught often, and it was a frustration when I was a young history student before I started doing my own in-depth research, is that I think too often history is taught as this sort of truncated, closed series of events, that this is how it happened. It definitively happened this way. All that matters is, I mean, most of the history exams I took from up until college were focused on just memorizing certain dates. So you had to memorize, well, this event happened on this day. Here are three people who were involved, and here's a 2-second narrative about why you should care. And I think that's a disservice to students. I think some of the things that we need to learn or reevaluate in the way that we teach history is how we can make it active and engaging, that it's not a closed circuit of events and it's still impacting their lives, that they should care deeply if they care about civic engagement, if they care about politics, if they care about the world around them, that the things that came before us are sometimes a bearer of those realities that we're now living in the wake of. So even if it doesn't seem as if something that happened 2,000 years ago was so important to you today, or 200 years ago, or 50 years ago, you're still living in the wake of those incidents. And you shouldn't be thinking of them as this closed circuit where it happened on this day and then after that day it ceased to matter outside of trying to get an A for a test. It's something that you can engage with, that you could debate, that you could hold up to say, well, what went wrong here? What went right here? Why do we need to keep remembering these moments? And I think that for my students, I'm always interested in enlivening that for them. And for our audience members, that's also a really big impetus behind how we do the episodes.
Let's take a listen to the clip now. And this is a piece from the episode in which you explain why you think Rosa Parks' story was simplified over time. So let's listen.
While there's no one answer to this question, I've given it some thought, and here are some potential reasonings. Although the bravery of Parks' activism and the success of the Montgomery bus boycott is celebrated today, the work she did during her lifetime to support civil rights wasn't always popular or safe. And in creating our country's history of itself, often on the way to spreading and telling stories more broadly, which is important work since these stories deserve to be told, there's also a rush to simplify. But the effort to focus on individual seismic events, like the Montgomery bus boycott, often trims the complexity of the biographies of public figures, like Parks and Dr. King. So Parks was shifted from a radical and dedicated activist whose efforts span decades to a tired woman on the bus in order to universalize her story, which is detrimental to the accuracy of her larger body of work.
Danielle, I'll use your own words. How does this all add up? And you mentioned earlier that you think it's a disservice for students to learn that simplified version of history. Mm-hmm. But is it also dangerous for us as a society?
Yes, I think that there's a way that if you don't know the full depth of a story, that sometimes it could narrow your ability to feel empathy for people whose story isn't exactly the same as yours. So if you place this great act of heroic and dangerous activism into a framework of, well, she was tired, then it paints that moment in time as this passive occurrence, that it just kind of happened. And I think taking away agency from historical actors is sometimes a really dangerous trend. And I think that sometimes, especially, and this is interesting because I make a show that only launches online, but sometimes there's a way that history has now become almost memes. It's a catchphrase or just an image or something taken out of context that does not give the full story, but is designed to make you feel as if you know everything. So it's an image and then it just says one line and that's the punchline, the takeaway. But history, I mean, even though I do joke a lot, history isn't a punchline. It's a story. It's a narrative that we're all building actively together. And so some of what I was interested in seeing Rosa Parks' story be truncated is, well, to whose service was it to make this story seem shorter or less interesting? Why is it that we think sort of teaching students breadth, all these dates with no through line rather than depth, which is critical thinking, engagement, and activism is more important? And I think that it really is a remarkable story that needs to be told more in depth and more accurately. But it's also that I think sometimes when we approach history from this attitude of, well, we should try to get through it quickly, the big test is coming up on whatever day, then are students really retaining that? Are they learning the lesson that you think that this should teach them? And I think, not that I think of my audience members necessarily as my students, but it is a similar kind of muscle that when I'm doing these episodes online, I do want to reach them in the same way I want to reach any student I encounter in a classroom. So I want them to feel that they have the power to question the things that I say, that they could, you know, be active and critical, that they could disagree as long as they could back that up with some sort of evidence, and that they can see that it's not just a static story that they have to accept the terms of, that they can challenge that. And critical thinking in all aspects of your life, whatever field you're in, is such sometimes a forgotten art, I think. I think it's so difficult to watch the way that history gets taught as just memorize and forget about it. Just memorize and forget about it. Because even if you don't end up in a humanities-related field, life is a series of critical exercises. You should be active and engaged in your own life. You should be utilizing your mind to think of new solutions and new innovations. And I don't think that there's anything wrong in breeding that into different parts of your teaching practice.
Do you think in the U.S. education system we're getting better at teaching critical thinking? Or do you think in this current socio and political situation we're at a stopping point? How do you think things are going on the whole?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So I hesitate to make too many broad generalizations only because I don't teach at the public school level or at the I teach only for college students at this point in the classroom. And I've only taught at private universities, but I have taught some high school students in different contexts. I think in general, too often when I hear debates about education, it's focused on perhaps the wrong outcome. And so I'm always interested in looking at different systems that are successful and thinking, well, how could we model that system or what makes it successful? And some of the reading I did for the episode on grades, and I want to make sure that this is correct. I want to say it was Finland that doesn't have any standardized testing. And I was just curious, and if that is not correct, I will send you an addendum on that. But I'm pretty positive it was Finland and they had no standardized testing. And I was reading that the outcomes there were so positive for students, that they had a really high graduation rate for students, that students, when they did finally have to take a standardized test towards the end of their high school careers, that they were scoring higher, that they were doing better. And I was curious to think, well, obviously there are some things that don't translate because the size of country matters and the amount of resources matter. But then I started doing some digging and I saw some statistics were saying they weren't spending necessarily more resources per student than we were. So what is it that's making all of these positive outcomes? And some of it was about teaching students critical thinking, staying away from very early standardized testing. The first standardized test I took in public school when I was a kid was in second grade, when I was 8 years old. And based on the outcome of that test, you start getting placed into different kinds of courses. And I found that in systems, not just in Finland, but in other parts of the world where they didn't implement standardized testing so early, that students were able to find their feet a little better. And then there was also a lot of discussion of what kinds of training the teachers were getting. And I always have so much admiration for people who teach young children. Very specifically because I remember, you know, my elementary school teachers, I mean, they're teaching you how to spell, how to write letters. They're teaching you how to spell the word nice and also what nice means as a concept, how to share, how to be a good citizen, how to go to the potty on time. I mean, these are the kinds of skills that a teacher has to teach you when you're at that really young and instrumental age. But I was curious that these other systems, that there was more contact between teachers and students. And I wonder how we could encourage that in our own classrooms, because it seems often that teachers are so stretched to the limit in terms of resources and time and the amount of students that they're trying to accommodate and all of these different factors that go on in the classroom, that how could we move away from thinking about it as, well, if things aren't going well, then we wag our finger at the student and the teacher and think about, well, how could we repair this system in a way that students and teachers are both better cared for in our school system? And systems that are not necessarily spending much more than ours are able to accomplish that. So I wonder what kind of reconfiguration we could do that encourages that sort of harmonious melding between educator and student.
I know Finland is also exploring, or they're actively moving toward, blurring the lines between school subjects in the upper grades. So when students reach mm-hmm. a certain grade in high school, they don't go to math class, then go to English, then go to mm-hmm. history. They explore one topic that's interesting to them and look at all the ways different subjects play into that. Mm-hmm. We can talk about some examples, but basically yeah. blurring the lines, not moving from classroom to classroom, exploring mm-hmm. an issue in depth, and then discussing all the ways that it factors into their lives. So they get this real world experience. They get out into the community and they meet people and they look at history as it stands before them. But then also when mm-hmm. they're in the classroom, they're reading about these subjects or about these topics from the lens of different subjects. How do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. Would you like to see that in America?
Oh, I would absolutely love to see that. I mean, the PhD program that I'm in right now is an interdisciplinary program, meaning that you take what you find to be the methods and benefits of different types of humanities programs and social science programs, and you put that into one cohesive project, because ultimately creative thinking, regardless of the field that you're in, usually does not happen very discreetly. So if you're trying to do something new and innovative, if you're trying to fix a problem, if you're trying to solve an issue and not just a hypothetical issue, it doesn't quite work as, well, now I'm done with the math portion of it, so I'm going to put that down and pick up something else. And I think that teaching students that they could be in control of the way that they incorporate information into their daily lives would be really beneficial. I also see so much discussion around topics of education about job readiness, you know, what's going to make students ready for the workforce. And some of that I do think is innovation. That's such a huge portion of how students need to learn to enter the workforce, not necessarily just thinking in terms of a one-to-one linear thing, but also thinking, well, how can I bring innovation into the market? How can I be a problem solver? How can I be proactive and independent and also learn to work collaboratively with other people? And I think that thinking across disciplines definitely encourages that, because there will come a point where you think, okay, well, the next stage of this process is that I'm going to need a chemist. And you find a chemist and you learn how to work with that chemist and you think how to move forward. And so I'd love to see that incorporated for students, especially because so many of the students I meet, they're energetic, they're smart, they're talented, they have all of this energy. I love being around students when they're sort of late high school and early college, at this age where, I mean, some people think that teenagers are horrible at that age, but I think they're wonderful. I think that they're at their best in some ways because they're learning about their autonomy, they're learning about what they want to do with the rest of their lives, they're thinking critically, and also they're not easily cowed. I find that those 16 to 18 or 19-year-old students, you know, they're very passionate in a way that's hard to replicate at an older age, because there's a way that they look at the world and they say instinctually, I want to do this because I think that it's right. I want to be a nurse because I think that nursing is important, and they have a lot of energy. And if you could foster it at that age, I mean, they'll maintain that and sustain that for the rest of their lives. But that's a great age for them to start thinking critically, not only about what they want to do sort of in a day-to-day workforce way, but also what they want to see, what they want to make happen in the world. What kind of work do they want to do?
Listeners, you're hearing from Danielle Bainbridge, the host of The Origin of Everything from PBS Digital Studios. And Danielle, if listeners are new to your show, where's the best place to find you right now?
Oh, the best place to find us would be probably on YouTube. So you could find us at youtube.com/Origin of Everything. Or PBS Origin of Everything, excuse me. Or you could find us on Facebook, and our Facebook page is PBS Origin of Everything. And we're also on Instagram, PBS Origin of Everything. So it's pretty easy to remember. Every platform, it's PBS Origin of Everything.
Just Google PBS Origin of Everything if you're in doubt.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. When in doubt.
We're going to take our short break, and when we come back, more with Danielle Bainbridge. We'll hear more from The Origin of Everything, and we'll talk about the representation of women of color in the media, because there's a new study out from an organization called the Women's Media Center. New numbers there, and we'll talk to Danielle about her thoughts on those numbers and how we can improve representation in media at all levels. So stay with us,
okay,
listeners.
Great.
More Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Friday on The Next Connections, the Fast Forward Film Festival is back. It encourages filmmakers to raise awareness about climate change and other environmental issues. So we'll preview a number of those films and take a look at what's going on in climate. Then in our second hour, new research on Parkinson's disease. We'll talk to local clinicians and patients. Talk to you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking to Danielle Bainbridge, the host of the PBS Digital Studio show, The Origin of Everything. Thanks for being here, Danielle.
Thank you for having me.
And I'd like to read an email from a listener who's a big fan of yours. And her name is Mona, and she's in Rochester. She says, as a nearly 50-year-old woman, I am so pleased to see a brilliant woman of color hosting The Origin of Everything. I feel represented, from her amazing brain to her beautiful natural hair. It's like seeing my own daughter on screen. I know Miss Bainbridge is aware of the importance of young women of color and how they see themselves on the air. She's representing us in the most fabulous black nerd way possible, and I'm grateful. That's from Mona. Oh,
thank you. That's great. Thank you so much.
Are you hearing a lot of positive feedback, especially from maybe young black women who are aspiring to be either academics or be in the media? Are you finding yourself empowering many different people?
So I'm a person who also never has taken a compliment in my life with a straight face. But I also, yes, I'd say the short answer is yes. And that's something to me that's so important. I think I meet so many talented women of color, black women who are eager and energetic to do these kinds of works. But sometimes if you don't see someone looking like you doing that work, it's this huge work of imagination that you're not only thinking about, well, what would it mean for me to be a director or for me to be a professional writer or for me to become an academic? But you're also trying to imagine, well, what would it mean for someone like me, since I've never seen anyone do this before. I don't have a lot of insight into it. And one of the biggest benefits to me is that in my own family and also in the women who mentored me to go into academia, I had so many wonderful black women who looked to me and said, you have talent and you have energy and you should, you know, do this work and you should move forward and you should push yourself and really enter the field. And I think it's hard sometimes when you think that there isn't an avenue for you or a space for you, especially in educational content, because I can't say that I see too many other black women hosts who are doing educational content. Not that they're not making it, not that they're not a ton of black women academics who I look up to and admire, but sometimes I don't necessarily see them represented on big platforms. And so when I had this opportunity, it was in the back of my mind to think, okay, you have a chance to do something that's interesting and smart that people could be enthusiastic about and also could stretch their imagination of what it means to be someone who is a knowledge producer. And what does that person look like? I used to joke that sometimes I'll show up to class on the first day and I wonder if my students are ever surprised to see me because I'm not, you know, I'm not an older man with elbow pads and a tweed jacket. Usually I show up in overalls and Doc Marten boots, but I'm still here and I'm still teaching you this class and I'm still invested in seeing them change their perception of who could do this kind of work. I love to see my students become confident and funny and energetic and innovative, and it's great for me to hear back from parents who say, my daughter loves your show, or students who say the women in their class love to watch the show. I want them to not only think critically, but also think critically about what kind of work they're capable of. They have so much enthusiasm, so much intelligence that they could do so many different things with their lives. And often, especially when I was in early college, I really faltered in the early part of college thinking about, well, what kind of career should I have? And part of it to me was that I thought, oh, well, you know, there aren't that many options. I should try to choose something safe and dependable and reliable. But ultimately, just because you don't see yourself represented in your dream field doesn't mean you have fewer dreams than anyone else. It just means that maybe no one else has done it yet.
I want to go back to what you said about there not being many options. What did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, everyone in my family, for the most part, was involved in either they were elementary school teachers or in healthcare, nurses and or physicians. So I thought, and I also am from a first generation American family. My family is proudly from Jamaica. So there was a lot of a thought process for me that the kind of career I should choose should be in healthcare. And it wasn't necessarily that my parents were restrictive. I think that they were actually quite understanding. For the most part, they always encouraged me to do whatever I did, but to do it excellently and to push myself. But I always thought, okay, so if you get kind of good grades and you're a reliable enough person, you should go into healthcare. That's the field that people go into. And it wasn't until I got to college that I thought, oh, well, this is not for me. I don't enjoy this, or I don't know if this is really my passion. So some of it was also that I assumed that people who were academics were, you know, like independently wealthy millionaires or something, that because I didn't understand how you could get a degree for 6 or 7 years without taking out some sort of huge loan. I wasn't aware that you can get fellowships. I didn't know what kind of things were available to you. So sometimes you need someone to tell you, and that's where my mentors really did me such a huge service in my life. And they were the ones who told me, apply to these places, they'll help you pay for it. Go here, there's someone who's going to mentor you and take care of your work and help you move forward. So sometimes it's about being in the know, and it's not that you don't have that skill. It's just that you need someone who does to tell you, someone who's already entered in.
In addition to someone telling you that, do you think if you had seen women of color in academic positions more often as you were growing up or as you were pursuing career options, do you think you would have changed your mindset more quickly?
Undoubtedly, probably, because in some ways, college professors represented in my mind were white men, older white men.
The tweed jacket, as you said.
Yeah, exactly, the tweed jacket. And so the thought process to me was, okay, so that's who has that job. And I'm not sure what it would mean to enter into that field or what kind of life I could make for myself. How would I accomplish it? And some of it was thinking about confidence. You know, can I get into a place that would let me do this? And the first professor who ever told me you should go to graduate school when I was 19, she was a woman like me. She was a first-gen American woman with Caribbean roots, and she had natural hair, and she was black, and she was teaching me this class. And I used to look at her a lot and think, I wonder how she got this job. Not because I didn't think that she was excellent, but I just was thinking, how do you get this job? I had no idea what it meant at 19. And it's fascinating when you go to college that you're expected to choose at 17 what you'll do for the rest of your life, because I certainly did not know at 17 that I'd be doing this. But it's usually about someone telling you. And so I saw someone who looked like me who told me and then introduced me to other women who looked like me who kept telling me I could do it. And that was a huge turning point in my life and in my confidence in myself.
In the coming days on this program, we'll be talking about a new report on the status of women in the U.S. media in 2017. And that study was prepared by the Women's Media Center. I'm going to read some data from that, and I want to get Danielle's take because, again, mm-hmm. it's new data. And as someone who is in this prominent position in the media, as she is, I think she'll have some thoughts. So the summary of the study is that women of color represent just 7.95% of U.S. print newsroom staff. So just about 8% mm-hmm. of print newsrooms, a little mm-hmm. over 12% of local TV news staff, and a little over 6% of local radio staff. Danielle, what's your first reaction to hearing those numbers? And these are from last year, 2017.
And these are all women of color?
Women of color, yes.
Okay, yeah, it's unsurprising to me, only because I've experienced similar low numbers going to events to promote Origin of Everything or going to academic conferences and just looking around the room and seeing who's there or giving a talk somewhere and looking up and realizing, oh, there's maybe only 3 or 4 of us in this room of 50 to 60 people. So that is something that I am aware of. So I would say the numbers, and maybe this is, I'm more pessimistic than most, but the numbers actually sound higher than what I would have anticipated. I was expecting them to be lower, even though they are extremely low. I think some of it, and this is also the nature, I think, of creative and collaborative work. And I talk a lot about this with other people who, you know, friends of mine who do freelance or who work in print or who work in media. And we do discuss this a lot, which is there is a way, and it's the same in acting or in theater, in any sort of arena where you have to collaborate with people and there's a creative process at hand, is that it takes a lot for people to trust a collaborator. Because we've all had, if you've ever made a project or done, you know, a diorama in seventh grade, you all have had that experience where you have a bad group partner and the process could just be torture. It's, you don't want to go to work, you don't want to hang out with them, you don't want to do this creative work. And I think that sometimes inspires people because a lot of times people get jobs through referrals or through being in the know. And that reinforces this kind of systematic inequality because they're saying, well, I'm not doing it because I'm trying to exclude certain people. I'm doing it because I know that my friend or my family member or this person I've worked with before already is reliable and that we'll work well together. And if we have to put in a 12-hour day, I'd rather be hanging out with this person than take a chance on a new a new unknown person. But what that does create is a sort of closed circuit of opportunity for people to enter in to the market. And even well-meaning people sometimes make that mistake. And I think sometimes part of the process of widening fields and widening opportunity is widening our own imagination of who could do that job. And I think sometimes it's, oh, well, you know, I've worked with this guy and he's been the designer for the show for the last 6 years. I'm just going to keep hiring the same person. But part of it is that you need to think, okay, well, what would it mean for me to actively look to broaden who applies to this job? If we get 600 applications and there's only one woman of color in the 600 applications, then obviously, statistically speaking, it's unlikely that that's the person who's going to get hired. But it's about thinking, well, why is it that there's only one who's applied, even though I know there are others who would benefit from knowing about this position? Or what am I doing to encourage other people to enter the field? And some of that is about broadening our scope of opportunity. Like I said, sometimes it's an active and sort of malicious thing that people want to keep things closed. But a lot of times I see it's almost a passive reinforcement. And it does come from that idea of, well, this job is stressful enough. I should just go with, you know, the person that my friend recommends who also looks like me or is from my same social circle. But it's about being a little bit more of a risk taker, because the benefit of having people with different perspectives at a table working on a project is, I mean, it's astronomical. You can't even measure it. I think when you're in a room where everyone is echoing the same sentiments, that the creativity often that you're trying to protect sort of dies. And then if you have someone with a perspective that isn't your own, I mean, that is when you actually make new and interesting work. No one on Origin necessarily, we don't all have the same background, but we have a shared energy and enthusiasm for the topic of sort of nerd culture stuff. And we bring in our own weird references and we push the show forward and we make that process better. And I didn't know any of them before we started working together. And it would have looked different if we decided, oh, well, we all should just work with people that we're already comfortable with. So it's risk and reward, that if you take the risk that you'll get this huge reward in the kind of content you can make rather than just reproducing the same comfortable thing.
My guest for the hour is Danielle Bainbridge, the host of The Origin of Everything from PBS Digital Studios. And let's dive back into the show, because there was one episode that really stood out to me in recent weeks, and it was the episode on why we wash our hands after going to the bathroom. And there was one term that you defined in that episode, the Semmelweis reflex, which just... Yeah. It struck me so much, because we're living in a world right now in which there's more of a push than ever for accuracy and emphasis on facts, mm-hmm. because we're often not seeing that that's the case. And hearing that term, the Semmelweis reflex, reminded me of the Dunning-Kruger effect, which, if you're not familiar, listeners, it's when people mm-hmm. have a cognitive bias and assume they understand a subject better than they do, perhaps to the point mm-hmm. of expertise. So when we talk about why we wash our hands and germs and bacteria and all that, there was one man who sort of figured out why we should do that before anyone else. And society at that time said, we don't really want to listen to you. Danielle, tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that story.
Oh, okay. So that was such an interesting story to look into, because part of it was, it started as a more tame idea where we thought, all right, let's do some early germ theory stuff or look into different hand washing campaigns that were popular. Because I think a lot of your listeners will probably remember times in their younger life where in the school bathrooms or in the hallway at the cafeteria or wherever it was, you would see these posters that would come from, you know, the World Health Organization or whatever, encouraging you to wash your hands. When I was a kid, I remember there was one piece of advice was like, wash your hands as long as it takes to sing happy birthday three times or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there was all of this talk about appropriate hand washing and how to maintain appropriate hand washing. So I thought, all right, you know, this is a cool topic. And it got pitched to me by one of my producers, and I wanted to look into it. But the story was kind of outrageous. So the first physician, he was a Hungarian physician whose last name was Semmelweis, he saw that women were dying of these illnesses when they were in childbirth. And there was an assumption at that point that it had something to do explicitly with childbirth, that that's what was killing these women. But one of the physicians in his hospital who performed an autopsy on one of these women's bodies also contracted the illness and died. So his theory, Semmelweis, was that small pieces of corpse were being passed from physician to patient, and it was killing both of them. And so he thought that this was somehow being integrated into the skin through small pieces of dead skin. So even though that wasn't necessarily it, it was actually bacteria and also viruses that were transmitting these diseases, but he didn't know what that was at the time. He was actually more spot on than he could have ever imagined, because he started having interns in the hospital wash all of their instruments and their hands in these like really strong antibacterial solutions that they were basically scouring everything after every procedure. And the death rate of women and physicians from these illnesses completely dropped off. But the problem was that the other physicians thought that his crazy theories made it look like they were passing diseases or that they were unclean and killing women. So they basically ostracized him. He lost his license. He couldn't perform medicine anymore. He lost his position at the hospital. And eventually, he was sending these letters, these open public letters, you know, kind of a la Martin Luther, and sending them to different physicians about how they were killing their patients. And he was committed to an insane asylum because they thought that he was a troublemaker, that he was out of his mind. But ultimately, and he died in the insane asylum, but ultimately, we found out years later that he was correct. And so the Semmelweis reflex is when you believe, because an idea is outside of the current cultural norms, that it's incorrect. So that you refuse concrete evidence just because the common mainstream idea doesn't align with what you think it should. And I thought, wow, that's a really haunting legacy, especially because part of the idea was that later scientists who came after him, who had similar theories about hygiene and heating things up and virus control and germ control, were then sort of lauded as geniuses, and he died in obscurity. And when I was looking at his name, I thought, oh, well, you know, Louis Pasteur, like his name lives on in pasteurization. And this poor physician from Hungary, his name lives on in an idea of rejecting evidence. So it was kind of a weird turnaround at the end of the episode when we realized that. But it also was, I think it was kind of an amazing takeaway, because I left that question open to the audience and people started writing in examples of the Semmelweis reflex, which is, you know, when you reject this evidence. And they had all sorts of different historical examples from science and from medicine, from historical claims. One wrote in a story from archaeology. So it was kind of interesting to see that this is a relatively common phenomenon, that's sometimes more comfortable to go with the majority than it is to accept a new idea, even in the face of evidence.
We're down to our last couple minutes with Danielle Bainbridge, and I want to turn to just your preferences and your favorite episodes. If you had to pick one mm-hmm. of all of the episodes you've done or have yet to go on the website that you're working on, which would you say is your favorite?
Mm. That's a hard question. I think one of my favorite ones still is History of the Hashtag, because that was, to me, so fun to explain and to work through. And I thought it was successful in getting a really sort of complicated set of ideas down to a concise format. I still, even though it was a very hard episode to write, I still enjoy Why Do We Have a North and South Korea? Because so much of our media coverage every day is focused on North Korea specifically, and also on the recent Olympics that just passed in South Korea. So I was interested in doing that episode, but it was also somewhat brutal to go through, because I don't study in-depth Korean history, but I thought, oh, well, wouldn't this be great to add to the conversation of, instead of just thinking of everything sort of Korean War onwards, that we were going to go back to the 19th century. And that was really fun. And then we just came out with an episode, Would You Have Joined the American Revolution? That was the one that aired on the 20th, March 20th. And I love that episode because it's a hypothetical situation that asks our viewers to do an active engagement with the question we're posing. And that's what some of the newer episodes are going to look like. So I really enjoyed writing that one, and I loved shooting it because it came out really great.
Well, it is an engaging show. It is a fun show. You will learn something. If you haven't had a chance to watch The Origin of Everything, I'm saying this is a personal plug for the show. So check it out. Google it. You can find it on where, Danielle? Give us the platforms
again.
Okay,
so I'm going to try to land this one this time. So it's youtube.com/PBS Origin of Everything. And we are also on Facebook at PBS Origin of Everything and Instagram, which our handle is @PBS Origin of Everything.
Awesome. Danielle Bainbridge, thank you so much for joining us on Connections today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me, and take care.
My thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer. I'm Megan Mack, and thanks to all of you for listening. Stay tuned for another edition of WXXI's podcast, Exited. It's a series about young people with disabilities transitioning into adult life. That's next on member-supported public radio.